Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and our topic today is soccer. And soccer is just about the favorite thing of my two morning show guests, their favorite thing to talk about, although they know a little bit about some other things as well. I'm really happy to have two of my faculty colleagues joining me today on the morning show, Steve Udry, who is a professor in the history department, and John Bruning, who is a professor in the communications department. I guess properly we call it CDM, don't we?
That's
Communication
true.
Digital Media. We've had the two of them on the show before to talk about what is an intense passion for both of them, soccer. They've both played soccer, followed soccer, and really do a great job of highlighting various aspects of this fascinating and important sport. And of course, right now, the Women's World Cup soccer competition is underway. And maybe some of you watched last night's fairly dramatic game in which the United States defeated Nigeria to advance further into the tournament. We're going to be talking about that first, but we're also going to spend a few minutes talking about the intense scrutiny under which the organizational group FIFA finds itself these days, and what the controversy is all about, and what might be ahead, and what kind of effect this controversy is perhaps having on the great sport of soccer, or football as it's known through most of the world. At any rate, Steve Udry, John Bruning, we welcome both of you back to the morning show.
Thanks.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
John, we have to take just a second to talk about the trip which you have just completed, which is just too interesting to pass up. It's something called J-term in June. So
right.
J-term typically refers to January, but I guess June starts with J also. So it's all fine. But you've done these trips before. Explain to our listeners what took you to California.
Yeah, so they're sports journalism trips, and so I bring students to see and report on games, essentially. And I started out doing a European soccer journalism trip. And I've done that three or four times now. We go to London and Barcelona, Paris, Munich, Milan. We usually go to three cities each January. And we see the top teams there. So we see, you know, FC Barcelona and Bayern Munich and Arsenal and others. And students report on games while we're there. And so I expanded the soccer version into a baseball version. So I just returned from California, where we went to five games over 10 days, basically. So we hit two in San Francisco, the Giants and the A's, two in Los Angeles, the Angels and the Dodgers, and then one in San Diego, saw the Padres, and met with some baseball people out there. Former Commissioner Peter Ueberroth we got to meet with, and some owners of the A's and the Padres and so forth. So it was really a great trip.
Wow. So when you say that they are covering games, do you mean that as literally as it sounds, that they would, in a sense, be writing up the article we would read in the paper the next morning about such and such a game?
Yeah, exactly. So they do research before the games and write previews about, you know, the team's form coming in and what's likely to happen, hot players, things like that. And then they watch the games and report on them afterwards, just like you'd see in the morning paper.
Cool.
Yeah.
So are these, generally speaking, CDM majors?
They come from all departments, really. I would say probably half of them are communication students, and the other half come from a variety of different disciplines. You know, some are education or history or business, marketing, all kinds of fields.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Professor Udry, have you been doing something that exciting over the last couple weeks?
No.
Well, the next time you do something interesting, be sure
I'll
to let us
know.
Thank
you.
Well, we're the first to know. Well, we got something real interesting to talk about today, that's for sure. Namely, the Women's World Cup competition, first of all. Let's start with the positive. And, of course, it's a really exciting thing. First of all, how does this compare to the men's competition, which we talked about last year in the midst of it? Mm-hmm. How would you rate its profile, both here in America and also throughout the world? I mean, is the fever comparable?
I guess short answer, no. I think the Men's World Cup obviously is a larger event in terms of viewership and sponsorship and just across the world. I think that's true not only here but in other countries as well. And really, in some ways, I think the women's game is more developed here than it is in other parts of the world. And so maybe we're more excited about the Women's World Cup than most countries would be, I think, in some ways. But, you know, in terms of a comparison between the two, there's certainly not much comparison to be made, but it's still a big event worldwide, and you know, it is such a popular game worldwide that I think it does draw quite a bit of attention.
Yeah, it has been growing, and it continues to grow. The first World Cup for women was in 1991.
91, right?
So it's fairly new on the scene. Mm-hmm. And as John was mentioning before, as we were chatting, the viewership ratings are well up over the last Women's World Cup as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's people are watching the games, I think, in higher numbers. There's Fox has reported some recent statistics. I think they had 3.3 million for the USA-Australia game, which was the first game that the U.S. women played in the World Cup, which was three times higher than any group stage game in 2011. So even that seems to suggest that there is an increased interest in it. But as Steve said, there's really it hasn't been around as long. The Men's World Cup started, I think, in 1930, and the Women's only started in 1991. So there is a difference in terms of histories, too.
Right. So not quite the same traction, probably, at this point. Right. Are the games absolutely identical? I mean, to my amateur eye, it appears to be the exactly same game. I mean, same number of positions and so on. I mean, are they identical games?
Yes. The rules are the same. Everything's the same. The style of play is even very similar. The level is different, but the women's game is improving very quickly. Some of the women out there today are just incredible players. Some of the shots and the goals we've seen have been stunning. Would have been impressive at any professional level in the men's game as well. But the rules and the referees and the everything about the game is exactly the same. There's no changing. Mm-hmm.
What about the structure of this competition versus the men's? And beyond whether or not they are identical or slightly different, how is this tournament put together? Again, for those of us who take a more glancing interest at at the sport of soccer and this competition, it's a little bit bewildering just what's going on? I mean, where are we in this grand arc of competition?
Yeah, we were talking about this morning, about how confusing the structure, I think, is to other people, because the tournament is run very differently than anything we're used to, I think, in American sports. We were trying to come up with an analogy and really couldn't, frankly, because there really isn't anything quite like it. So it's different in that they have groups. They have what they call group stage play. So at the very beginning of the tournament, everybody plays a series of round-robin games. Each of the teams is put in a group of four teams, and so they each play each other.
And is that random?
It's somewhat random.
Right. The groups are always uneven, and there's always the group of death, which is the very difficult group to get out of.
Right.
There are seeded teams and then other teams that are placed into them.
Yeah, so there is some, their previous performance has something to do with the way that the groups are structured.
So it's probably a little bit like the way a tennis tournament is put together with the seedings, and you spread out your most powerful teams.
It is, yeah. The only difference is that these group stage games are not single elimination, right?
Right.
So every team is guaranteed at least those first three games, and then based based on the results of those first three games, then they seed a single elimination bracket, essentially. And so that's kind of the stage where we're at now. So the American team has played the other three teams in their group. They came out on top of the group. And so of the four teams in each group, the top two advance. And the bottom two typically are done. It's a little bit different this year because there's six groups and there's 16 teams that are going on to the next round. So there's a few third place teams that are getting through. But essentially, the top teams in the group go forward. The bottom teams in the group drop out at that point. So that's basically where we are now. Today, actually, are the final group stage games for the whole tournament. So after today, they'll have the bracket in place. And then it works just like, you know, the NCAA or any other tournament, a tennis tournament, as you're talking about. So we're basically at that stage now. So this works to kind of seed all of the teams into those brackets that then becomes a single elimination tournament.
Right. At a glance, at least, it appears that Germany has a team and the United States has a team. So in that way, it's sort of like Olympic competition, correct?
That's true. Yeah, it's their national team, so they're the best players from each nation, which is, with women's soccer, that's really the primary organizational structure in which they play. They've had difficulty getting professional leagues, at least in the U.S. There are professional leagues in Europe, France, Sweden, Germany. Other places have more extensive professional leagues where they're playing on clubs like they do in the men's game. But in terms of the women's game here, the national team is really the dominant team.
So is this a competition then, well, I guess like the modern Olympics now, is this kind of a mix of professional and amateur? I mean, what are those? How do those two elements balance each other?
Yeah, in the sense that professional women's soccer is not widespread across the world. There's nothing that dictates that it can only be amateurs or only professionals. As John said, it can be anyone who makes it onto a national team. For instance, in the men's national team for the U.S., there's now a college player, which is very rare. Most of them are professional players, but in our national team, which will compete in the Men's World Cup and qualifying, which is coming up, we do have amateur athletes involved in that. So there's no stipulation like there is in the Olympics. Well,
or was.
Was. saying that it has to be amateurs.
And are they competing for prize money? Or is this, in that respect, is this an amateur competition? And you're competing for the glory.
It's mostly for the glory. Yeah. It's mostly for the glory. Various associations will give prize money to their team if they win. I'm frankly not sure if you actually win a cash prize if you win the Women's World Cup, but associations will give bonuses to those women who do win.
I was reading I think a day or two ago, I was reading that there are certain fine American players who are actually playing for other countries. And of course, I think we talked about that when we were talking about the men's competitions. So it sounds like that's not unheard of, and particularly if the United States is an especially strong soccer power on the women's side, it makes sense that not all of our best players are going to make it onto our own team.
They have to have some nationality, I think, right? Some kind of heritage from another country in order for that to work out. But there certainly are players, like European players, that play on American college teams. And I think there would be some Americans who have, I think they have to have one parent who has enough kind of lineage from one country to play for that country. So there are sometimes choices to be made about their national heritage. But generally, it's citizenship that qualifies them to play.
Right. Of course, on the men's side, the United States was a presence, but not exactly a force to be reckoned with compared to other giants. But on the women's side, America is way up there. John, were you saying they are actually ranked number two, right?
Yeah,
behind
right.
Germany?
That's right. Germany is the top-ranked team in the world, and the U.S. is number two, followed by France at three, Japan at four, Sweden at five. So it's very different, I think, than the men's game in terms of the major powers, although Germany is number one in both. So they're certainly maybe an exception to that rule. But the U.S. men's team, I think, is usually ranked somewhere in the teens or the 20s.
Usually in meaningless rankings.
Yeah, yeah. The rankings could be debated too. But but generally speaking, the women's team in relation to the rest of the world is much, much stronger than the men's team.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking about the Women's World Cup Soccer Competition with two soccer enthusiasts and experts from Carthage College, two of my colleagues, John Bruning from the CDM Department, Communication Digital Media, and Steve Udry from the History Department. We should just take a moment, as we chatted about this a little ahead of the program. It was just too interesting to not bring this into this on-air conversation. The matter of how journalists often characterize particular teams from particular countries and how so often that will be wed to certain stereotypical ideas we might have about a particular country and its people. What prompted it was something I read about last night's game, which was the U.S. women defeating Nigeria 1-0. And I read an article in which the play of the Nigerians was characterized as a strange mix of joy and thuggishness. And I just loved that phrase, but I hadn't stopped to think about the kind of the deeper ramifications of if you adopt that kind of rhetoric as you talk about, for instance, Nigerian teams. So, Steve, I think you were the one who first reacted to that.
You think?
Yeah.
Yes. My comment was that that fits neatly into the current stereotypes of Africans in general. If you look at Hollywood depictions of Africans, it's typically a machine gun toting male who rarely smiles and has just this sort of thuggish attitude towards them. In the media, the typical depiction of Africa and Africans is one of corruption and perhaps banana republics or dictatorships, which is of course incredibly problematic. So the thuggishness of these women soccer players ties neatly into that current stereotypical notion of Africans, and the joy with which they play is something. Well, their music is lively and their fans are always playing on Congo drums and whatnot and singing throughout. So we have this again, almost the opposite, but it fits neatly with this idea of the thuggish African, which also has this joyous side to them where they're singing and dancing and
relatively simple people.
Right? Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And it's actually, it's backed up in the literature too. I teach a sports media course, and one of the things that we read in there is about they did a content analysis of sports reporting of international events, and they really found that across the board you had these kinds of stereotypes in the ways that the teams or the players were depicted in terms of our own stereotypes about that nation. So the Germans, for example, are organized and disciplined
and precise and regimented,
where the South American teams play with more freedom and joy and, you know, just different kind of the ways that the actual play is described really tie in very closely to the ways that we, you know, tend to stereotype other cultures.
So in other words, if there were a way somehow to magically erase the national logos from their uniforms, and if we could watch a given game being played between two teams without any notion that those are the Germans and those are the Nigerians, you're suggesting that actually the nature of the play and how the teams function really tends to not reflect those stereotypes at all. I mean, that the Germans really aren't regimented and the Nigerians really aren't thuggish or whatever. Or not to the extent that the rhetoric would suggest.
Right. That all teams are regimented and all teams play with a bit of thuggishness to them. They have these players who have their roles, who play differently. The Nigerian woman who was kicked out of the game, who received two yellow cards, which equals a red card in soccer, she just mistimed a few tackles, and they were pretty vicious tackles. But certainly the same could be said of any nationality who has a defender who's going in to win the game and win the ball. So nothing particularly thuggish about them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so I suppose when we're talking about any kind of competition which involves teams from various nations, this is something we really have to be careful about. I mean, it's a specter that's always there, the possibility of these stereotypes, however latent, being right there below the surface in what's being written and discussed.
Absolutely. There's and John can probably speak to this a lot more intelligently than I can, but there is a large body of research that looks at those kinds of issues with reference to these large nation-based competitions, and including the Olympics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's certainly true, yeah. I think anytime you have national teams, as you're saying, Greg, that is a risk in the coverage of those events too.
Something else about last night's game, which I'll admit I did not watch steadfastly start to finish, but watched quite a lot of it. I happened to watch the moment when there was this kind of cataclysmic collision between an American and Nigerian player. I think our best player was the American who was...
It was Abby Wambach, I think.
Right. And then one of the Nigerians. And they were both attended to on the field for quite some time. The American eventually got up, but the Nigerian was sort of prone on the ground for quite some time. Mm-hmm. How common is that for those kind of moments to occur?
Yeah, we tend to think of soccer as a non-contact sport, but in many cases that's not true, especially I think with the head. And Steve, you can probably speak to this more as a former player. You've been knocked around a few times, right?
I've had a number of concussions and I've had stitches in my head a number of times because of this, as well as broken arms and broken legs from playing soccer. Mm-hmm. So
just you personally?
Just me personally,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. The injuries are fairly common. And hard tackling and physicality is very much a part of the game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, when you watched those two teams last night, that is America and Nigeria, did you see much difference in the level of physicality and certain lines of either decorum or the plain old rules being crossed more by one team than the other, or is it roughly comparable?
No, roughly comparable. Mm-hmm. I would say perhaps the Nigerians had more fouls just because the U.S. players were a little bit more quicker, a little bit better on the ball. Mm. So if the U.S. player gets to the ball a split second before the Nigerian player, who is also going after that ball, then the Nigerian player's not going to get the ball. They're going to get the U.S. player's foot or something like that. Mm-hmm. But we have some very tough players in our defense and, well, across the field. So I would say that really it was probably a matter of skill, maybe some intent, some ability that led to the Nigerian player being kicked out of the game for these yellow card fouls.
One of the articles I read said that basically America's play has been slightly disappointing compared to their official standing or seeding or whatever you want to call it. And the article said the very same thing about the German team, which is ranked number one, mm-hmm. that both of them have been slightly underwhelming, or there have been certain points of concern about the level of their performance. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think everyone sort of assumed that the Americans would dominate because they have had so much success historically and because they are so highly ranked. And they did what they needed to do, right? I mean, they got out of their group and they're now moving ahead in the tournament and so forth. But they did only score 4 goals in 3 games, right, which is not a particularly high output. And the game that was maybe... most interesting was the second game against Sweden, which was thought to be kind of possibly the best game of the three, which ended in a 0-0 draw, right? Which nobody wants, frankly. I had some friends who traveled to the game that drove to Winnipeg to see the game, and I thought, oh, how disappointing that must be to see a 0-0, not even to see a goal scored by either side must be unfortunate. But, I think that they have maybe underperformed a little bit. There was a press conference in which Abby Wambach blamed the turf which has been a big issue. It's all being played on, this tournament's all being played on artificial turf, which is quite unusual. The men's game has never done that, and probably never would, according to the women, which I think is probably true. So there has been maybe a lack of goals, but the defense, I think, has been really strong. They've only given up that one goal in the three games, so I think that side of the ball is performing really well. So I think they're starting to click. I thought last night they looked better than they had in the previous two games in terms of their passing and their play in general. So I think, you know, it's not as good as maybe we thought it might be going in, but I think they're still on pretty solid footing going forward.
How about Germany?
Well, they have been doing better, actually. I mean, they had some very weak teams in their group. I think they won their first game 10-0.
One of the soccer?
Teams. Yeah, that's very unusual. But one of the new teams, I think it was Ecuador. Is that right? Was the first team that they? Oh, it was Ivory Coast. Their first game, which they won 10-0 in just a breeze, and they did win their group. I think, again, just overall the kind of perception, I think, of the tournament has been that it maybe hasn't been as exciting. There haven't been as many goals scored, except for in a couple of those real lopsided victories. There were eight new teams in the tournament this year who had never been in the World Cup before. They expanded from 16 to 24 teams, and so eight additional teams that had never been there. And some you wouldn't imagine, like Spain, for example, had never had a team in the Women's World Cup. Costa Rica, the Netherlands, the Dutch had never had a women's team. So some of these real men's powerhouse teams hadn't even had women's teams placed in the World Cup before. And so now that there's more teams, the thought was that, you know, we're going to have kind of a lot of uneven games, that there's going to be a lot of lopsided results. But so far, you know, there have been a few, but generally speaking, it's been pretty low scoring. So I think maybe that's the general perception, even though Germany's, you know, still looking strong.
Right. Most of those new teams have played fairly impressively, and will probably go back and see huge bumps in women's soccer in their countries. Thailand, I watched Thailand play last night, and their goalkeeper was incredible. And these young women are doing their darndest against these teams, which have just much more experience than they do.
And Cameroon actually went, they advanced. This was their first time ever playing in the World Cup, and they advanced out of their group. So they're still alive in the tournament, which I think nobody expected. So there have been some really strong performances from some of those teams, too. Hmm.
So going ahead, what is your sense of any other spoilers that are emerging, or does it look like we're headed for an almost inevitable U.S.-Germany showdown in the final game?
They might even be on the same side of the bracket. It depends.
We
may not work out in a way that those two teams would end up in the
final. So that's not determined yet.
Right, yeah. It depends on where they finish in the group. So the top team in the group goes to one side of the bracket, and the bottom team goes to the other. Mm-hmm. And so depending on what happens today, in fact, France, who's another very highly ranked team, I think they're ranked third, and they're in some trouble today of not actually going through. So it's not necessarily holding exactly to form, I don't think. The Canadians obviously are hoping that their team will do well, which is another highly ranked team. I know they want to sell as many tickets as they can. They're not sold out of tickets yet, so they're hoping the Americans and the Canadians continue to do well in the tournament so they can continue to have viewership and attendance at the games and those kinds of things. So I think it's really pretty still up in the air. I mean, the Japanese team, which won 4 years ago, is still in it as well. And China has a very strong historical record in the tournament, too.
Not as good this year, but but strong. They have a tradition, as it were.
So there's definitely still a lot to be determined. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion at all at this point.
So, and for instance, I don't think we know who we're playing next.
That's right. Yeah. It depends on the results of today's game. There's four games today. So it depends on what happens there. We know the date. The next game will be Monday the 22nd. So next Monday night they'll be playing again, but we don't know. We know it's in Edmonton, so we know the venue, but we don't know the opponent yet.
I'm wondering how one watches all these different games. I mean, I know what I watched last night on a very standard television show, but I mean, if you want to follow the team from Cameroon, how does one do that?
Mm-hmm. Well, they are broadcasting most of the games. So
and
if
who's
you have,
they?
It's NBC or no, it's Fox. I'm sorry, it's Fox. Fox. Yes,
it's Fox.
Right.
Yeah.
NBC does Premier League football in the men's division, but it's Fox, so you probably watched the game on Fox, regular Fox network last night. They're showing all the American games on their regular broadcast channel. But then they have their cable outlets, Fox Sports 1 and Fox Sports 2. So, you know, yesterday I was watching, some of the games on Fox, but you have to go a little bit deeper to find those other games. But
right.
and some of them are going on at the same time during the group stage too. So you really can't physically watch all the games because they are going on concurrently.
Right.
You can flip back and forth, which
DVR.
I do, yeah, or DVR. And I think from this point forward, all the games will be either on regular Fox network or on Fox Sports 1, which is their main cable outlet.
We should probably spend a moment at least talking about the American's best player, or at least best-known player, Abby Wambach.
Mm-hmm.
What makes her especially strong?
Well, she's most known for her ability to head the ball. Mm-hmm. She had a reputation as an incredible header of the ball, scoring certainly many of her goals by using her head as opposed to using her feet.
She's tall, but, she's physical,
right.
She's really a strong player. Mm.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And shockingly, this tournament, her heading has been a bit off. So last night's only goal in the game, she scored off of a corner kick where she would usually use her head. She used her feet to score the goal, and it was a beautiful goal. She's now scored, I think, 14 goals in the Women's World Cup, only one behind the all-time leading scorer in the Women's World Cup, who's a Brazilian woman named Marta.
Hmm. Who's still playing.
Who's
playing today, actually. So they're kind of neck and neck. She has 15 goals, and Abby Wambach has 14 now, so they're kind of going for the all-time lead. So she's had a strong record of performance in, I think this is her fourth World Cup that Abby Wambach has been playing. But they have so many good players, too, in addition to her. She gets a lot of the attention.
So this is not like the Cleveland Cavaliers with LeBron James.
No, not at all.
Alex Morgan is a really great
Morgan
player.
Alex Morgan is one of our best goal scorers now. But she's been injured, so her playing time has been limited up to this point. She played a lot more. I think she played 65 minutes last night, but she's still not in full game fitness yet. And you could tell the U.S. team played differently. They actually played better with her on the field.
Mm-hmm.
Up front, moved more. There was more quick interchanges between the players. But really, the story for the U.S. has been the defense. The defense has just been incredible.
Mm-hmm.
This woman, long blonde hair, Julie Johnson, or Johnston, I can't remember.
I think it's Johnston, yeah.
Johnston has been a rock, solid as a rock in the back. And, of course, the U.S. has the world's best goalkeeper, this very interesting personality named Hope Solo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who, she's been, obviously, we were just talking about this morning because, Alex Morgan, when you were talking about her, I was thinking about, if you don't know her, you haven't been watching the commercials because it seems like she's, she's pitching nationwide and Chapstick and, it seems like every commercial during the World Cup. But Hope Solo, who's had some legal trouble recently in a variety of different settings, has really been kind of, I don't want to say shunned, but she's certainly been put to the background in terms of the promotion of the team and that kind of thing. 4 years ago, Hope Solo was really one of the big superstars of the team. And now they just did the Sports Illustrated cover with the team and they had four players from the team on the Sports Illustrated cover, but Hope Solo wasn't one of them. They brought in Carly Lloyd and Sydney LaRue as other players, which are great players. Don't get me wrong, but Hope Solo has been sort of cast as in the background, I think, during this World Cup.
She's been, I believe, indicted at least on domestic violence charges.
Mm-hmm.
Fights with, I believe, her half-sister and her half-sister's husband, but I'm not sure of that. She's gotten into drunken scuffles with police. Transcripts just came out recently of her interactions, really pretty ugly interactions with police. So The question, of course, has been asked, oh, how can you let this player play on our team? Well, she's the world's best goalkeeper. So that's
how. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with two of my colleagues from Carthage College, Steve Udry and John Bruning, who are both extraordinary soccer aficionados and experts, and we've been talking about the Women's World Cup competition. We do want to spend a few minutes talking about something not nearly so positive. Not that Hope Solo's escapades off the field are positive, but largely this women's soccer story is a really exciting and positive one. Not so much when we get to the matter of the controversy surrounding FIFA. As ahead of this conversation, I want to make sure I understand, is FIFA only associated with men's soccer?
No.
Okay.
FIFA is they call themselves the quote-unquote guardians of the game. Hmm. FIFA was founded by a Frenchman, a guy named Jules Rimet, in about 1904 in Paris as the game was beginning to grow internationally. They decided that rules had to be set, that there had to be a governing body that would control the internationalization of the game. And so in 1904, Jules Rimet set up this FIFA organization.
And they do the men's and the women's World
Cup. They do the men's and the women's. They oversee all aspects of the game in that sense. And FIFA is made up of actually six different federations, which are regional. Hmm. The U.S. is part of a federation called CONCACAF, the Confederation of North, Central, and
Caribbean
football associations. Hmm. The South American Federation is called CONMEBOL, and then you have the European Federation, which is called UEFA, and then you have the Asian Federation called AFC, and then there's an African Federation, which is CAF, and then Oceania has its federation with Australia, New Zealand, and smaller island states. And so these six federations are the main regional bodies that constitute FIFA's makeup. But then within each country, within all of these federations, there is its own federation. Mm. So the United States has a soccer federation that has a president, and they would be members in this. So there are in total 209 members, member associations within FIFA. And these 209 members are broken down into these six federations. However, when you're electing the president of FIFA, as they recently did, they re-elected Sepp Blatter, who we'll talk about momentarily, I think. Each of these members has an equal vote. So even though soccer is huge in Brazil, they only get one vote, and that vote is equal to any state's, the Rwandan Association's vote. So this leads to all sorts of issues and questions, but primarily it leads to this corruption scandal in the sense that it leaves it ripe for countries that want to host the World Cup, which is similar to hosting Olympics in terms of prestige. It opens the door for bribery and for scandal. FIFA as an organization brings in over $1 billion a year just from the tournaments it runs, and from marketing and all sorts of things that it does. But in terms of its costs, its costs are minuscule. It merely has to run a bureaucracy. Okay, so there's tons of money that's floating around that is to be used by the guardians of the game, quote unquote, to develop the game, to support the development of the game across the world, men's and women's games. And so FIFA uses this money to support the game's development. And of course, in many of these states where the development needs to take place, oversight of how that development is actually given out is fairly loose. Mm. for instance, the United States. Oversight used to be fairly loose in terms of where exactly the money was going, and the regulations on how it moved around were not always totally opaque.
So part of the problem is the misuse of money, the misallocation of money. I mean, sometimes for someone's maybe personal gain.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Ugly. Yeah.
Well, when you have that kind of money, which is not tracked so easily, I think it just breeds that kind of, or it lends itself very easily to breeding that kind of corruption.
Right. Mm-hmm. What about the matter of specific bribery? Who is bribing whom and for what potential gain?
We're going to find out. We're going to find out. But it seems right now that the charges have been worked like this. In May 27th, the Swiss authorities crashed a FIFA meeting. FIFA's headquarters are now in Zurich. So they crashed this big meeting of the whole association. It was at their annual conference when they were going to vote on a new president. So the Swiss authorities, acting at the request of U.S. authorities, went in and they arrested a number of top level FIFA officials. And this all springs from U.S. investigation on tax fraud of a high-level U.S. soccer official, a guy named Chuck Blazer. I think he was born in New York and did a lot in Connecticut, but he rose up fairly quickly through the ranks of our federation, the CONCACAF Federation. First he rose through the United States Soccer Federation, then he rose into the top level of the CONCACAF, where he became the top lieutenant of the president of CONCACAF, who is a Trinidadian named Jack Warner, Trinidadian toboggan named Jack Warner. He became his top lieutenant. And U.S. tax authorities caught Chuck Blazer. They caught Chuck Blazer quite a while ago. They caught him in, I think it was 2011 or so. They caught him on tax evasion and wire fraud and something like conspiracy to hide money or something like that. They caught him. He had been living the high life. He had even rented two apartments, I believe, at Trump Towers. One was about $90,000 a month, and the other was about $60,000 a month in Trump Towers. The $60,000 one was, I think, used by his pets mostly, either his dogs or his cats. I can't remember. But again, we're talking about huge sums of money, which, okay, may be allowed to be used for rent, but, you know, where's the limit?
Right. And what does this have to do with fostering soccer? And yes,
exactly.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so he was the original. He was prosecuted by a Brooklyn prosecutor. And so he was the sort of the genesis of these corruption charges. He became very tightly linked to this Jack Warner, who's the president of CONCACAF. And we seem to have caught him with a $10 million possibly bribe from the South African football or South African government for support to have the World Cup played in South Africa in 2010.
Mm-hmm. So it all goes back to the bidding process for the World Cup, right? Because this was the South African World Cup. So in order to get the World Cup to South Africa, you know, they spread some money around to people that had votes about where the World Cup would be, and Jack Warner was one of these people. And then FIFA ended up actually paying that money to Jack Warner directly into one of his accounts that he controlled personally, right?
Yeah, he was in control of this development fund. He was a sole fiduciary.
And I see, now I understand what I didn't understand at first when you were saying that because FIFA is set up the way it is, where you have all of these small, relatively poor countries who nevertheless each possess a potent vote.
Exactly.
I see how the scenario almost invites this kind of corruption and bribery to occur.
Exactly. So,
And going forward, too, I think the World Cup, Men's World Cup, has been awarded to Russia in 2018 and to Qatar in 2022. And so seeing that we're now have evidence of the bribes that went into the last World Cup in South Africa, well, two times ago, in 2010. I think there's a lot of questions about what's happened with these 2018 and 2022 votes, and I think they're planning to revisit those to kind of see if some of the same corruption perhaps happened during those bidding processes as well.
FIFA is denying that these are actually bribes. We have evidence that there's this $10 million that went to CONCACAF, this Jack Warner's federation, and went into this development fund. And FIFA is saying that this was just regular business, that this is exactly what it should be doing. But we now have evidence that this money was sent over to CONCACAF under the authority of the number two person in the FIFA organization. And actually, the British Associated, which is it, a British press organization has found apparently a letter from the South African Football Association addressed to Sepp Blatter, the president of FIFA's number two lieutenant, this guy named Valky, saying that we accept that FIFA will pay us $10 million less than what they said they will, with the assumption that that $10 million will now go to Jack Warner's CONCACAF Development Fund.
And so, you'd want to put that in quotes, right?
Right. and so this...
That's what he likes to call it. But,
yeah. Just like my bank account is my development fund.
So we now have to start... We've indicted a number of these top FIFA officials, mostly from the CONCACAF and the CONMEBOL region, in the hope and the expectation that we will now be able to trace this money flow, maybe pressure these people so that we can get to the top person, Sepp Blatter, who initially was saying his hands were totally clean, but he just recently resigned from his position after just having won a re-election battle a couple weeks ago.
That sort of speaks volumes in and of itself, doesn't it?
It may.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to be following this with great interest, needless to say, and I appreciate you laying it out as clearly as you did. And we continue to watch the headlines and the complicated articles beneath the headlines to try to understand just what is going on and what is ahead for the great sport of soccer. In the meantime, this has been great fun today. I'm so glad we got to do this, and onward and upward, and look forward to further conversations about soccer and other things that are important to you. So, John Bruning from the CDM department, Steve Udry from the history department, I'm so glad we did this today. Thank you for joining me
today.
Thanks,
Greg. Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, a couple of different author interviews, one of them with William Cohen, the former defense secretary of the United States, who has left public life for a successful career as a writer. And we'll talk about his most recent novel, a thriller called Collision. You'll find the morning show archived at WGTD.org. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general.